Welcome to episode 73 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, a political scientist at UNC Charlotte, though I haven't actually been to UNC Charlotte now in over a week. But today I'm talking to Jonathan Rosen. He's assistant professor of criminal justice at Holy Family University. He's done a lot of research on a variety of things, but especially on Central American gangs and organized crime in Latin America in general, among other things. But he's also served as an expert witness in 95 immigration cases, the majority fleeing gang violence in Central America, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Jonathan, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Thank you. And this is a timely topic, too. So just to start with, how did you start serving as an expert witness?
So I got approached by a couple nonprofits. They were doing some cases, and they tend to be kind of convention against torture cases. So basically, you have to prove that more or less there's a 50% chance that if you get deported back that you're going to be killed or tortured. And when I started writing more on gangs, and it happens a little bit of a, you know, most academics, we kind of write books and articles, and I laugh sometimes that I write books that no one reads. And so there's kind of opportunity to do this type of work and really help people. So I was getting approached more as a result of some of the gang research. And it happens to be that the countries I study, you know, when you look at El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are where the majority of people are coming from. So I've served in the cases in those three countries, as well as Mexico, Colombia, and Nicaragua. So those are kind of my area.
And just out of curiosity, because it's been a while since I've done them, but I've done some expert witness cases in Charlotte, is where's the court?
Yeah, so that's another interesting thing. Even though immigration court is federal, I've done probably cases, you know, a ton out of New York, New Jersey, Florida, Chicago, or San Francisco. So I do a lot of the testimony telephonically.
Gotcha.
And you really do notice, though, that even though immigration court's federal, like going in front of a judge in Texas is really, really different than, you know, San Francisco or New York. And so most of them require you to do a report, kind of an affidavit, and then usually they try to have you testify. And what I like about immigration court is it's kind of cool as an academic. You know, is the expert testimony weighs a lot, because it's they're asking something, you know, a hypothetical. Well, is this person going to get killed or tortured? So in reality, you know, in criminal court, they bring in a ton of experts. Sometimes your opinion weighs less. But in immigration court, I've actually found that, like, you can kind of use your academic knowledge to really help, you know, answer questions. And at the end of the day, the judge decides. But, you know, you can kind of make an impact in a positive way.
Yeah, and it's fascinating talking about the different parts of the country, because in Charlotte, there were, at the time, I think it was either four or five judges, and there was intense discussion about the different personalities of the judges. But I'd even thought about, you know, the framing in Texas versus the framing in San Francisco, where those could be immense differences.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. And I think sometimes the lawyers will ask me, do you think we're, you know, and I'm not a lawyer, you know, I'm a PhD, but it's you know, I said, well, this is going to be a really difficult case to win. And they say, well, why do you say that? And I say, well, you're in Texas. The judge is granting 1% of cases.
Yeah.
So that means 99% don't win. So in those type of cases, you're kind of setting the record for appeal. But I've also noticed, like, a lot of judges, even in places like San Francisco, where you'd assume they'd be always much more liberal, a lot of the judges are former kind of DHS attorneys, Department of Homeland Security, and a lot of them come rotating through. And so I've noticed that, like, sometimes you think that you're going to have one judge just based on where they are that would have a certain opinion, and you realize, like, it really does – you know, the criminal justice system and immigration court in general is just interesting, and really people do matter, I guess. And not every judge's interpretation is a little bit different. And so I've had some really fascinating cases in Texas and different places that I thought were kind of would be slam dunks in New York. But, you know, it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah. So what's the typical kind of personal story that the migrants have in your cases?
Yeah, I mean, so they are actually, even though every case is different, you definitely see a pattern. Almost every case that I do deals with people fleeing gang violence. And so when they tend to be young males, they tend to be kids who are being forced recruited. And they tend to be kids who are forced recruited, either threatened that they're going to be killed or their family members killed, or they tend to then be extorted. And then I've done a lot of cases relating to – sexual violence and really sad cases with using involving women and children, and in terms of, being viewed as this kind of horrific thing of girlfriends of the gang or property of the gang. And so you tend to see in these kind of convention against torture cases, like I did a case once where this kid's entire family had been killed by MS-13. Everyone. Wow. There wasn't anyone left. And I'm kind of thinking, like, the judge asked me, well, what do you, Dr. Rosen, what's your opinion about why he's going to be tortured? And I'm thinking to myself, like, really? Like, out of this case, is the one everyone's dead. Like, it's – and so it tends to be a really – people from marginalized communities, people from areas where there are gang presence. And this issue that comes up all the time is the issue of whether state collusion or there's lack of confidence in the police. And so I think that's probably 80% of the cases that I've done. And they tend to concentrate in Northern Triangle and have a very clear profile.
Okay. And that makes me think also is that, you do these and then you go home and then you might be doing research for another one. How does that affect you as you're just sitting there and thinking about all of these people's lives and the fact that many of them will be sent back?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, so, I think that another issue too is that, is the person detained or not? I mean, I've done a couple ones where they're individuals who've been sexually assaulted by gangs. They have PTSD. It's documented by a psychiatrist. They're living in these jails. They can't have received bond. And so some of them have said, listen, if I lose, I just can't take it anymore. And so I think it starts to, I guess it's my way of trying to help people that I really think are in need. But, you really see, wow, the amount of suffering that people have experience, it really does impact you. And I think the ones too where the people are detained and then they, let's say they lose and they go on appeal, that could take a great amount of time until they actually are in front of a judge again.
Yeah. And actually, I want to before getting to the next question, because we had been chatting about this just super quickly before I hit record, but talk a little bit about the backlog.
Oh yeah, I mean it is really, really overwhelming in terms of the backlog. There's around 900,000 cases in immigration court. And so I've had a couple attorneys where they'll call me and they say, okay, Jonathan, are you ready to go? And I'm thinking, yep, ready. And they say, oh, 4 years from now. And I'm thinking to myself, really? And they say, yes, listen, the docket for the judge, the judge is booked. And so you get these cases that are pushed back so long. And I think when you look at it from the individual's perspective, like, they're really in limbo. And I think it's a very stressful. And so you see cases. I've had a couple that are pushed out a couple years. I think with the coronavirus, it's going to get worse.
Of course, yeah. You
can see pushed back cases being canceled left and right. And so I think the fact is that, like, they don't have enough immigration judges. And the ones that they have, their calendars are so booked that it is a very bureaucratic system, just overwhelmed with cases.
And when you said 4 years, that really hit me because there was a case I did. It was 8 or 10 years ago, I'm guessing, and it was in December, and then it snowed, and especially in Charlotte, when there's snow, practically everything shuts down, and so they didn't have any. They shut the court for the day. And then they had to reschedule, and they rescheduled it for 8 months later, which at the time I thought that is amazing, like 8 months. And now, a decade or a little less than a decade later, that's just blown apart.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think the other thing too, like 9 out of 10 people who don't have attorneys, they lose. So I think there's kind of strategy where they can either hustle you to court and try to get you kind of off your toes. They just gets pushed out so long because they're so overwhelmed that people voluntarily deport. And so I think that's, I think there are a number of reasons, but, and it's definitely gotten much more difficult, that we could talk about to win. And I think that's also the appeal process is slow.
Yeah. But actually, before we get to that, I wanted to finish up talking about what you have to do. So when you are serving as a witness, talk a little bit about specifically what do you have to show?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And so I think most of the cases I do are convention against torture cases. They're known as CAT cases. And so you're trying to show this element, and it's really changed with the administrations, but you're trying to show that this is very extremely likely that this person can be killed or tortured if they go back. And I think that the challenge with that is the interpretations have changed. You know, what does it mean to be from a marginalized group? What does it mean to be making a political statement? But many of the cases tend to add up where it's, you know, for example, someone is living in a poor neighborhood. They reject MS-13's, you know, offer, I guess, you know, to join a gang. They get beaten up or killed. Their family members are tortured. I just did a case where I think like I lost count about how many people had been killed. And so you're trying to show if they get deported back that they're going to be killed or tortured, and this element that the government can't protect them. And so a lot of it comes down to this question of, you know, credibility. And I think as an expert witness, you're saying sometimes, you know, I try to speak with a client, but I'm reading the declarations. It's like I'm going based on what the information they're giving me and assuming that, you know, that is correct. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, what's the MO of gangs? How do they operate? Is this a credible fear? I think some prosecutors will really pressure you, trying to give you that you a number, and it's really impossible to say it's, you know, 98%. So I tend to use extremely likely as opposed to a percentage. And you're trying to show that. And usually when you go to court, they have the cross exam and they can really kind of open things up and try to like one of the issues I've been having is, you know, how do you find impunity? And I've been talking a lot about corruption in Central America. And I once had a judge go on for 30 minutes about how I defined impunity and saying, well, aren't they making reforms? Isn't this a good thing? And so sometimes you get into the weeds depending on the prosecutor, or the judge. But in general, you're trying to show that it's extremely likely that this person's gonna suffer.
And when you're writing for your own affidavit, is that are you coming up with as much data as you can, data and history, or how do you go about doing that?
Definitely. No, that's a really, really good question. So I think in general, you kind of have the country conditions and you try to tailor as much as you can. So if it's the data really helps about gangs and extortion, and I think that's kind of the scholarly aspect of it. And a lot of the cases, like if I'm doing a case about young kids and forced recruitment, saying, well, what are the numbers? What does the information show? And I've done a lot on women who have been victims and kind of showing crimes against women, you know, femicides against women. And they really do. You know, sometimes as an academic, I wonder, are they going to read this report? They really do. And they'll say, well, why did you cite this report and not this report? And they kind of get into the weeds. Sometimes they'll ask you a lot about different methodologies, depending on the prosecutor. But you're trying to build and tailor that case around the client, and it usually – or the individual. And it usually always comes down to this question of, well, what's the relationship between the state and organized crime? And, well, why can't this person just relocate? Why aren't the police going to protect this person? And that can be sometimes tough in a country like Mexico where it's so big. They sometimes want to say, well, why is this person so important that they're going to be killed or tortured?
And you've talked about this a little bit, but how does the government lawyer generally respond to you? I mean, is it an intellectual discussion, or are they really pushing on you?
So I think some – it's a little bit of a tactic of them. I've had some that have been not so pleasant. In general, my experience is they try to push, but they turn to be respectful. I've had some that haven't been too respectful, but I always appreciate it when they are. And they try to kind of bring up and poke as many holes as they can into the person's, you know, claim. And sometimes they'll have the issues of, well, you know, you wrote this or you cited this study, you know, aren't things changing, or aren't elections changing? Aren't there reforms that are happening? And so I think like the relocation issue always comes up, and this issue of, you know, even though there's corruption in the police, haven't they made a bunch of reforms? And so I think some of them tend to be pretty, you know, aggressive, and it tends to be this kind of intellectual argument, but then trying to pinpoint things and make you slip up. So I think it's not for – it really definitely – you have to have thick skin to do it. I, you know, actually really enjoy it, but they definitely press you on a lot of things. And sometimes the judges are not always, you know, silent as well, and will really ask a ton of questions.
And you had mentioned this before, but what's changed over time? So as far as the government stance, or you know, the backlog, how things are successful or not? How's that changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. And in reality, with the new, with the Trump administration, with first with Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, now with Bill Barr, I mean, they basically tried to deny asylum claims on all grounds. And so you try to, you know, the attorneys try to argue on different grounds of what's asylum, certain kind of recognized social groups. But in reality, they've made it much, much more difficult to win. And so, like, when you go to some states, an immigration court, particularly Texas, you know, Arlington, Virginia tends to be very tough as well, you know, in the South, Atlanta, you have some very, very tough judges. And now they've made it so they can deny asylum claims on so many grounds that, like, when you go to Texas, because there's a moment where I thought, like, well, why do I accept cases in Texas to help? And then I realized, like, you're going for the appeal. And I think the other thing that's interesting is, like, I this case that I mentioned where the entire a young male who was, I think, like 17, he was detained and he called me to thank me of working on his case. And, you know, we won and the government appealed. And this entire kid's family has been killed by MS-13. I'm thinking, this is a case you're going to appeal on? And so I think they're kind of following the prosecutors, that is, or orders by, you know, the attorney general and the governor saying, look, you got to fight all of these, and you have to try to appeal all of these, and the goal is to win. So I think that it has gotten much, much more difficult between the previous administration and the current Trump administration, and it's much easier to deny claims. And now, you know, the attorney general, it seems like every couple of weeks, is making a new memo about, you know, how being a victim of gang violence isn't, you know, doesn't mean that you should be granted asylum. So I do think that that makes it a lot tougher. In terms of, you know, the expert, kind of the angles you have to look at, and the questions they're going to ask you. I've had a lot of questions about, like, what constitutes. I mean, every single person that I do the case for is, I'd say 99.9% are from marginalized communities, really, really poor neighborhoods that are plagued by gangs and violence. And so this question is, well, are they a recognized social group? What distinguishes them? Why should they be, you know, a granted asylum. So I do think the legal interpretations have continued to change.
I guess I hadn't thought about, as much about the government appealing. Do they just appeal everything now, or does at some point they just throw up their hands and say, okay, fine, it's done?
Yeah, I think they're selective. I do think they try to take to the certain cases, they try to be as tough as they can. I don't think they appeal everything, but in general, I think that it has gotten much, much harder. I mean, I've been in front of some judges where you kind of look to see who you're in front of. I mean, the attorneys kind of do the research. You saw this person's granting 2%. So, I mean, there's a 98% chance you lose. And so I think that's the other thing. I think the other thing, too, is, like, a lot of the judges are former, you know, as I mentioned, former DHS employees. And so I sometimes think that, like, people often don't realize how important immigration court is, but I really, really do think that, like, it is, you know, something that until recently has kind of been understudied about, like, wow, how things have changed and just how much of a backlog this entire system is. And I think the Trump administration has really tried to roll back so many of the changes, even though the United States legally has recognized these for, you know, decades. And so I think Barr, in many ways, and Sessions, in terms of their goals, have been successful in trying to make it as difficult as possible. The other fun little fact is sometimes they'll ask you, well, has the government ever asked you to testify for them? And no, but the real reason is also that they don't ask experts in immigration court on the government side. So sometimes they try to point out, you know, are you biased? Are you some academic that's only. I've had the cases where they say, like, well, do you realize your attorney works for a nonprofit? They're an activist. And I'm thinking, well, but they're still an attorney, right?
Yeah, and I mean, and it's the government is there to just assume that the person shouldn't get in. I can't imagine them asking an academic to try to make that case. I mean, I can't imagine who would be making that case.
No, and I think what they try to do is point out bias. So they
Yeah,
try to
sure.
point out, you know, whether you are, you know, you've just seen it's become more of, you know, the situation of how can we get as many cases in and out as quickly as possible. And I think the other thing too is that, like, you know, they'd have to hire a lot more judges to clear the backlog, and then from the attorney's perspective, getting the evidence for some of these cases too really takes time. And I think what people like don't always realize is like when you're fleeing gang violence, the first thing you think about is not like, oh, let me get my documents for when I go to court. You know what I mean? Like it's just you kind of pack your bags and leave. And you see these a lot of these stories with extortion are just really sad. And I think the interesting thing in a sad way about gangs is that like they extort their own. I mean, they extort everyone in the neighborhood, but they target people they think are vulnerable. And so they're not extorting really, really, wealthy businesses in Latin America and Central America because they all have private security. They're extorting a lady selling, food on a street truck. And so I think it's you see these cases tend to be individuals that really, really are desperate and are fleeing horrific situations.
So, to what degree do you think the COVID-19 is going to affect the number of cases moving forward, like the number of cases? But then I guess I would also ask about the backlog, or does it? Do you think it's going to have a big impact?
Yeah, I do. I think that the immigration court is basically shutting down, and I think that it's going to just increase the backlog. In terms of the number of people asking for asylum, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but I think it's going to have a big impact. I mean, I think, and it's hard to really know for how long. I mean, I had a bunch of cases scheduled for April and May, and they've all been pushed. And I've had a few that have pushed years out. And I think that's a scary thing, too, is that, the judge gives you the date based on their calendar. But sometimes you ask, like, well, what does this person do if they're detained? Do you just sit in jail for 3 years waiting to have your day in court? Because 95% of the individuals can't afford to be, bailed out. And so I think that's also a challenge when you look at the practicality that I think it really wears on people and the human element. And I think sometimes as an academic, we run numbers and we look at data, and we don't remember this human connection. And I've testified in court a few times, and I think it's a different interaction, even though you try to be professional, when you're actually seeing the person there than if you're, it's just a name, And so I think this kind of emotional element too, like it really makes me, it's changed my opinion on a lot of things and really makes me wow. Like it's, I try honestly to do as many cases as I can to help as many people. I've turned down some cases, for gang members. I just, for different reasons, I'm not really interested in working with them. So, I mean, most of my cases are individuals I think are women, children, and victims of a really horrific situation of violence.
And so the courts are just closing. Is there precedence for doing any of that remotely?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think now with the coronavirus, it's just been such a nightmare. I think they have to figure out a way to do it. I mean, I'm not sure 100% the precedent for doing it remotely, but I mean, most of my testimonies are telephonically, so I definitely think that it's possible and it would help speed things up. And I'm not quite sure because I'm talking to different attorneys, like how long this backlog is going to last for some of these cases, because many of them say like we don't know when they're being rescheduled. And I had an attorney of mine say, well, some of the systems still function in California and it's just been a total nightmare and we're overwhelmed and we're trying to figure out what to do and what cases to reschedule and when to put them on. And I think the other thing too is like when you're near the attorney, building up on the expert's calendar of when he or she can do it, building up kind of the, preparation and just to say, oh, well, let's go 4 years from now. And a lot could change in 4 years.
Yeah, but it's mind-blowing because you have to assume that at a minimum all of April's shot,
Yeah, definitely.
and in all of the immigration courts across the United States, they're shuffling people in and out all day long, with multiple judges. So you just think of the number of cases that aren't going to be heard just in the month of April, and there's already been some in March, then bleeding into May probably. That's just a massive number.
Yeah, I think it's a mess. And I think honestly, one of the reasons I don't do it in person is just time, because sometimes they'll want to talk to you for 10 minutes on specific issues and say, look, we read your report, we saw what you said, we just want the prosecutor has a right to cross. And some judges don't want to hear from the experts, and that's okay too. They just will take your report as what you would have said. But when you look at this type of issue, it's like, yeah, like so how I've gone to a couple of cases where it's in person and like the judges are triple booked. And I went to one where we literally waited like 7 hours. And I'm like,
Oof.
look, I can't. It was in the summer. So, I'm kind of not under contract and was just doing research. But, I've just seen in normal circumstances without the coronavirus, they're triple, quadruple booked. And now what happens when you have, this just mess of a situation, and people, like you said, exactly, shuffling in and out. Like, how does that affect the system? And just also scheduling, across all these different courts, it is a complicated business, to say the least.
And so just one last question is, do you have any basic advice for people who might have the opportunity to do this?
Yeah, I think in many ways I was lucky that kind of my research and scholarly interest aligned with people who are really in need. And so I think, like, I mean, we have a lot of you and I have a lot of contacts and friends who do all this type of work already. I think there's a lot of wonderful institutions like the Kids in Need of Defense Fund, the Make the Roads Foundation, and a lot of big corporate law firms take on cases pro bono and set aside a number that they do for free. And I think they tend to put experts on certain lists. But I also think sometimes it doesn't hurt to reach out to the Kids in Need of Defense Fund or reach out to different organizations and say, hey, I'm an expert on X, Y, and Z. Like, I've had some say, or, you know, do you study Ecuador? And I said, well, I'm really sorry, I don't. But I could give you names. And so I do think being proactive can definitely help. And I kind of look at this as a way for me, at least I see it this way, of really helping people that I think are in need. You know? And I can try to do as much as I can to at least give my, you know, quote unquote expert opinion on a topic that I know something about. And so I definitely would encourage people to utilize their skill set and try to get involved if possible.
And I think that's obviously true for anybody who studies Central American politics.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. I've been talking to Jonathan Rosen, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Holy Family University. Once again, Jonathan, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Have a great day.